Hey everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LPFM 102.7 and 103.9 here in the heart of the universe, in the very center, the core of the universe, Clear Creek County, Colorado, downtown Idaho Springs on this fantastic, beautiful first Saturday in December in the year 2016. And we are getting a little bit of snow coming into ski country here, so we're going to keep hoping and we're going to keep coming on that. But we got a great crowd in town today, so we're glad you can join us. And this is The Rabbit Hole, and today I have a double feature of Writer's Talk, two authors coming in. And so the first hour, and we'll start talking with Catherine Spader here in just a few moments, and she's going to be talking about all her work and how's it come together and so forth. But before we do that, I do want to thank our sponsors, all of them, because without our sponsors, community radio like this would not be possible. So thank you for keep supporting KGOAT. Okay, and it's just pretty awesome that you're doing that. Okay, and in particular, I want to thank Tommy Knockers for bringing that last dollar to us. Tommy Knockers is one of our great community contributors and supporters. And so thanks, Tommy Knockers. And if you get a chance to get there, the people in that brown ale, I'm just saying, it's like, for me, primo, you know, it's like I can't get it. Well, I can get enough of that after a couple, but I just love it. So thanks, Tommy Knockers, for all you do and everything. And this next hour here on The GOAT, I am sponsoring. So you can learn about more about my work, and that's Sisyphus Wins. And you can go to my website, jerryfabianic.com, and learn more, as I say, there about it. And if you'd like to get a copy, well, just let me know. We'll talk about it, get any questions, things like that. So in the meantime, though, let's just enjoy the hour. So, Catherine, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be here.
All right. So glad that you're here. And so let me just tell the audience a little bit about the listening audience here. Catherine Spader is a first-generation American raised on the history and love of medieval Germany. At age 11, she saw the skull reliquary of Charlemagne and became enthralled with the era. Catherine is a registered nurse who specialized in emergency and trauma care for 20 years. She is also a medical writer and editor and has published over 1,000 articles. Catherine feeds her inner Wolfheden by playing ice hockey. Oh, I love it. This is great stuff here. And she and her husband, Craig, also enjoys prowling the wild forest and historic sites of Europe and the American West. And wow, it looks like you got some real deep interest here.
Yeah, like to do a lot of things.
All right, very nice. So, anyway, tell us a little more about you. You were a registered nurse. Now, are you still one, or what do you do?
I still have my license. I'm, for all practical purposes, retired from nursing, and also a medical writer and editor. And I've done that for the last 10 years or so, and have gradually, finally, been able to have the time and the right place and time to be able to write my novel, Write Support, thanks mm-hmm. to my husband, Craig, who encouraged me to just finally get that book done.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're originally from Chicago area?
Suburbs of Chicago, yeah.
Okay. And how long have you been here in Colorado?
Since 2002.
What brought you here?
Well, most of my family had moved out here, but also, of course, the beautiful mountains, of which there are none in Illinois.
Kind of flat?
Kind of flat, yeah. There's not much for terrain there at all, so I've always wanted to live in the West, actually, so.
Yeah, no, this is fantastic, and you live in the metro area, so, you know, ski country, the mountains in the summer, they're just right out your back door.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
So you like to mountain climb or hike or anything? And stuff
we
like
do
that.
A lot of hiking and camping, and we mountain bike mm-hmm. as well. So
yeah. So then you decided to start writing a novel. What prompted you? What got you going?
You know, it's something I've always wanted to do, literally since I was a little kid. Even when I was first learning to write, I always had a journal. I was always writing some little story. Like I said, by age 11, when I went to Germany and saw a lot of castles and you know, fairy tale places, and then some somewhat unsettling, creepy places, like seeing the skull of Charlemagne and, you know, the reliquaries where they'd keep bones of saints and that kind of thing. Just all that, like, just piqued my imagination, and just stories wanted to come out from that, so...
Yeah, I would imagine that kind of tied in somewhat with your prior profession as a trauma nurse and stuff like that, and say, oh, skulls and bones and that sort of thing.
I do kind of like bones. I think they're fascinating.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they're sculptural, and they're cool.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were age 11, you went to Germany, and you saw this here, and your novel, we'll get to it, Feast of the Raven, is focused, I think, in this time period here, so probably, what, 12? 1300 years ago, somewhere in there, in the medieval times, in a couple of ways you could say it. Do you think that's what it was that got you particularly interested? Why not write about, for example, the Sumerians in, 4,000 years ago, or Egypt or something? Why Charlemagne and medieval Europe?
Probably because of traveling there and really, when you actually physically are in the place that these things happened, and you feel it, and you smell it, and you touch it, it really does sink into you on a very deep level. I personally love all kinds of history from all over the world. I just love history, period. But I found that the places I've been lucky enough to go to, really that history then turns into something that you read about in a book or on the internet or something, into something very real when you've actually been there. Once I've been to a place, then all of a sudden there's a new book idea. In fact, the summer we went to Spain, and that'll be my focus of my next series, is a book that takes place in Old Spain. So,
Old Spain, as in what?
As in Roman Spain, yeah.
Oh, so like a couple thousand.
Iberia.
Iberia.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Iberian Peninsula. They called it Iberia.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wonderful. So when you're traipsing around the forest of Germany, the Black Forest and so forth, because I think this ties in with mythology and spirituality too, the German Teutonic paganism or whatever. I'm assuming that. Is that the case? And if so, then do you bring that into stories? Did you do research? What gets you going here?
Oh, well, lots of research. Like I said, being there, I went two years ago, I went to Germany specifically. I visited some family as well, and I also went to research the novel. I had been in the area where the novel takes place. In fact, that's where my family comes from, is that general area. But I wanted to go back there with the new eyes, knowing I'm writing a book about this now, and get really into the nitty-gritty of going to some specific battle spots and where there's fortresses and whatnot. And the most moving thing I did, which I knew it would be great, but it just blew me away even beyond my expectations, was visiting the Externstein, which are the stones that are pictured, the big natural stone formation that's pictured in the cover of the book. And it's a very striking place. It's got a lot of legend and myth that surrounds the place. There's not a lot known historically exactly what all went on there, but many of the theories include that it's been a place of pagan worship for a very long time. The Christians did move into it later on in the later Middle Ages and use it as a monks or hermits there kind of place. But it's in the middle of the Teutoburg Forest, which is also quite a mythologically entrenched place, too. And it's in northern Germany, and it's really something to be there and... to compare it to anything, it's kind of like a natural Stonehenge, I guess I would call it.
I was ready to ask you that. Yeah, because this is a natural formation.
It's a natural formation, yeah.
Okay.
It wasn't built by man, but it's got that, and it's much larger, actually, than Stonehenge, but it's kind of got a similar monolithic feel to it, and you can see why it was not only just a landmark, but sort of an attraction for people since the beginning of time, because there's just something very special about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think not to get too far off at this particular subject, but for example, you mentioned Stonehenge, and one of my ultimate favorite places to go and just love it is in Chaco Canyon in northwest New Mexico. And there it's just the open desert, and up on this butte, the natives, the ancient natives there, were able to manipulate a couple sandstones, I mean massive rock slabs, that when the light from the sun goes over on the solstice, either the winter, which is up and coming within 2 weeks, or the summer solstice, it casts shadows on these markings here. And so when, you know, whether it's Stonehenge or, how did you say this particular one?
Externstein.
Okay. And Externstein and, you know, and Chaco, they do hold this very powerful energy for those people who practice their spirituality there. You know, so, and I'm not as well versed in German Nordic mythology, Odin and so forth, but it seems that there was like, who was the guy with the trumpet? Was it Wilhelm or something? And then the stag in the forest. I mean, this is just, I mean, there's amazing stuff. It could get all wrapped into these stories here, it seems.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the sun thing at Chaco Canyon, because I was there in March, so I wasn't there at a solstice time, summer solstice, but according to some things I've read, there is a place up in the tower, the tallest rock of the tower, where they carved out a chamber up there into the rock, into the natural rock, and there's a window, so there on the summer solstice, the light will fall into this little round window and literally create a little shape of an arrow that goes across the wall. I haven't seen that myself, so I'm not sure if that's exactly truth or if that's sort of a legendary type thing.
It is.
But
yeah, if you were there in March near the time of the equinox, all the buildings, everything structured there in Chaco, is aligned either with the sun's movement or the moon's, and it's the only place, as far as I know, that the megalith. One place, it's a site, it's up atop of Fajada Butte, that measures accurately both the sun and the moon's cycle. The moon goes through a cycle every 18 and a half years. I never knew that. The where it comes up on our horizon, it sort of not wobbles, but comes up. And then after 9 1/4 years, it goes back the other way. And I mean, it's just amazing what these people do. But, you know, with your story, the Externstein, okay. And where in Germany is this again?
Kind of north central Germany in the Teutoburg Forest. It's not too far from the city of Paderborn, if people are familiar with that.
So I have a friend who's planning on moving there. So when I finally get to Germany, then I really...
Oh, you have to go there.
Yeah.
Well worth it. And there's the forest itself is fascinating and just wonderful fairy tale forest. And they have an extensive trail system through there. Mm-hmm. So it's just, I'd recommend it for anybody, really. But
yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is just that, I get chills thinking about this sort of stuff here, you know, and I love it, of course. So let's talk about the work itself, Feast of the Raven. Tell us a bit about what's the storyline here?
Well, in short, sometimes I like to tell people it's a twist on the Red Riding Hood tale.
Okay.
Quite a twist, but in Red Riding Hood, you have a tale where you've got an innocent girl and a big bad wolf, and the big bad wolf manipulates her, and in the end, eats her, and of course, he gets it in the end too. In my story, there's a lot of other things going on, but part of the story is the tables are turned on the big bad wolf in this story, shall we say, and without, you know, giving away too much of a plot or anything. You've got a big bad wolf type character who, in essence, is trying to find his identity. He's trying to find redemption. He's someone who is caught between two different cultures, two different religious beliefs, and doesn't really fit into either one. He's half pagan and half Christian at a time when Christianity was under Charlemagne taking over basically all of Europe, and he doesn't fit into Christian society and is exiled, and he's got a lot of anger over that and those kind of issues. And part of the reason he's exiled is, and this is where the fantasy part kind of comes in, is because his father was one of these Wolfheden creatures, which is a kind of a legendary, mythological, but yet there is some evidence for them in history. A warrior who channels the wolf spirit to become kind of this half-man, half-wolf-like, unbelievable, you know, undefeatable warrior. And it's believed that, you know, this type of warrior did exist. Now, they weren't actually probably shapeshifters as we would think of it today, but in those days, that's what people thought. And that made him very much viewed as a demon in Christian society.
Right.
Since he had that blood running in his veins, so.
Yeah. Oh, this is intriguing. It's fascinating. And so many levels, not only for me intellectually, as a lover of literature and mythology and so forth, but personally too. So I'm really excited about getting in here. When you were talking here, you know, the character, does he have a name?
His name is Gerwulf.
Gerwulf, okay. And he's conflicted.
Mm-hmm.
He's spiritually, he's half and half. And we think of people who are two different races, for example, okay, or they are their mother is Jewish and their father is Christian or Islamic or something, but there's some dichotomy to them that they're not whole in a sense of mm-hmm. what we look at the cultural thing there. And it seems to me, and maybe Catherine, you could talk about this, we both admire Joseph Campbell when we come back to that, but a lot of Campbell's stuff comes from Jung, Carl Jung, and the archetypes. And so what I'm seeing in this is the symbolism of what this man, Gerwulf, okay, and with the struggles, those of us that have two spirits or two, does that kind of play in? I mean, I'm just, maybe am I reading too much into the story, or what you're thinking of?
No, you're absolutely, you're really right on hitting the nail on the head, so to speak. Like what I, sometimes what I'll talk to people about, and just as an icebreaker, when they say, oh, so you wrote a book, and what's your book about? Well, it's kind of hard to explain in a sentence or two, but I'll say to them, well, how would you feel if your mother was Christian, your father was Muslim, and you grew up in a Christian society and were very ostracized because you're half Muslim, and but then you were sent over to Afghanistan to fight,
mm-hmm.
and there you go. And so it's a similar situation in my book, only it's 1,300 years ago.
Sure.
So.
But it's, you know, it seems to me that you have this character that the reader, even though it's the timing of the place is 1,300 years, but it's real. It's now for us because, you know, maybe he was divided, you know, whatever, conflicted, but many people in our society are today. And so when we read that, we could start identifying with the character. And you said, though, earlier about how the wolf, like in Red Riding Hood, it's the bad wolf. So there's that image of the bad wolf. Whereas in Native American folklore, the wolf is not bad. It's a very powerful motif in there. In fact, that's what I say on my animal totem. And so is the wolf, okay? And so the canine, the dog, and whatever. But when you say he was the bad wolf, it seems to me that it might be a character that we can feel empathy for. So he's not all bad. Would that be, you know?
I would say he's very much more human than anybody thinks he is.
Nice. I like this. Explain that. Tell us more. Why do you say that? And it gives some, yeah.
Well, I've drawn kind of upon some of my work as a nurse working with mental health.
Okay.
And stuff that I see his wolf persona is kind of that anger that he has personified,
mm-hmm.
basically embodied anger that he has growing up as he did in an extremely, without giving away too much, but extremely abused environment,
mm-hmm.
Not just ostracized, but exiled, physically abused. That kind of thing. So that wolf in him isn't really, in my mind, it isn't so much his like blood, demon blood from his father. It's more his own demons that he's fighting inside.
Mm-hmm.
And his whole, and he's, well, people in those days fought a lot and killed people, you know.
Unlike today.
Yeah, unlike today, right. Yeah. So, yes, he's done some bad stuff. Yes, he's not. He's kind of an anti-hero. I think of him more as a protagonist, anti-hero type. But he's looking to belong. He's looking to get rid of that wolf anger inside him. And that's his quest in this story, is he's looking for his identity and for his place and to be part of a tribe or a pack. He's looking for his pack, literally, so to speak. Now, what he thinks is really the right way to go is that's another, mm-hmm. You know, he's pretty convinced of his path is a certain way. Now, whether that's really the right path for him or not is all part of the adventure. So.
Oh, you just hit on so many points here. You just made amazing statements here, Catherine. And you said, first of all, anti-hero. Okay. Explain that. I was an English teacher, so I get it. But many of our listening audience and say, so he's against a hero, is anti. But what do we mean when we say a character is anti-hero?
Well, you probably can explain it better than I can.
Because I was a teacher and everything. So.
I guess my idea of an anti-hero is somebody who does, like, is trying to become better than himself, but he doesn't come from a perfect place. And he's not all great and wonderful and perfect all the time, and has a lot of dark sides to himself that he either has to deal with or overcome, or you know, find ways to mitigate or whatever.
Yeah, and you know, and really, we think, because it's not against a hero, but when we think of a hero, we think of these perfect people that, or they overcome some stuff, you know. And I always go back to Star Wars: Luke Skywalker. Eventually, he becomes Jedi Knight. And he struggles, and okay. So Luke was always a good guy.
Right.
And he had a struggle with his father.
Right.
And then revenge for his aunt and uncle. Okay, we get it there. But there's others too, you know. So, and a classic example, I mean, one of the greatest, two greatest works in American history are Huck Finn and Great Gatsby. So mm-hmm. Gatsby and Huck are anti-heroes.
Mm-hmm.
They're very flawed characters. But we identify with them, and we're with them, even though we know they're not the perfect type, and they keep making some pretty poor decisions along the way, and we empathize with them because guess what? We're just like them. And that's what it seems to me, that Gerwolf is in that line or that vein then.
Yeah, I would say absolutely. He's kind of in a spot partly because of his genetics and his mm-hmm. something he can't help, but he's also partly in his conundrum because of himself and because of his own choices mm-hmm. too, and the guilt he carries for some of the things he's done is something that is also part of that whole dark wolf side of him that he's trying to, his guilt that he carries in his heavy conscience is symbolized by the Raven, which is actually a character in the book. The Raven itself is a character, and that's the Raven shadowing him is that's his, you know, that guilt you just can't get rid of.
Okay, yeah, the dark burden. So we're now thinking of Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
I love this stuff here. Guess what I used to teach? Okay, yeah.
I actually used the word nevermore one time in the book. I just couldn't resist it. I asked my editor, I'm like, to Edgar Allan Poe? And he's like, nah, you only did it once.
Yeah. Yeah. And after I got done teaching him, dragged my kids through, because I would use it to teach traditional poetry, you know, mm-hmm. onomatopoeia, alliteration, all this other stuff there. And we would dissect it. We would have fun with it. And then I would show him the Simpsons version of the Raven. I don't know if you've ever seen it. And it was great.
I think you did a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah, just pull it up if you get a chance. I mean, it's just hilarious, you know. And there's Bart there. Are we scared yet? And there's, the dad in Simpsons, Space Husband.
Yeah. Homer.
Homer, yeah. And he's, I mean, it's just a real parody on the story. But we digress here, so I digress. Now, when I said you packed a lot into a couple statements there, we talked about the anti-hero. The other thing, kind of tied together, is the quest and then his search for a tribe. Explain that more, because I want to come back. These are very powerful motifs in stories for heroes. So,
well, like I said, he is kind of torn between these two different worlds, this, you know, this Christian world and this pagan world. You know, in some ways you could say, well, how interesting, you have a very interesting background. But especially in those days, you didn't want to be an interesting background. You wanted to be a part of something, you know. I think we all have that desire to feel like we're a part of a specific, whether it's a, you know, a group or a tribe or a pack, you know. And I thought right away, you know, the wolf analogy with the wolf pack and everything just ended up working out so perfectly. When I was beginning to write this story, I was considering using other animals to symbolize him. And, yeah, and I came up with the wolf and then, you know, learned about the wolf warriors that really did exist. I'm like, okay, we got a story now. So.
Yeah. No, and I think you're hitting on it, because you, when you're talking, you said earlier about being 1,300 years ago, but it is this search for identity. And when one is born into a family, which is the smallest unit of a tribe, your family is your immediate tribe, and then there's the neighborhood, and then the larger community, the town.
The village,
you know, we get out there, and then we have
the kingdom.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then it ties in with, if you have a spiritual practice, you know, so maybe you're Catholic or Mormon or whatever it might be. And then those all become, you know, elements, and you do the Venn diagram, you know, the, you know, different connections. And they all are, you're a member of these tribes. Well, the problem for an individual, as Jung or Joseph Campbell might put it, a problem for the individual is that when he or she does not fit into the tribe and begins to identify or understand that, for whatever the reasons are, and you just say, I don't fit here, I don't belong, and you don't know why you don't, you just feel it. You don't feel like part of him. You don't feel comfortable. And so you have one, a couple choices. You can submerge all that, and many people do. And they go along and with the tribe strictures and so forth and stay where they were and lead perfectly miserable lives. They're never happy, but they're dutiful people, and they keep doing it. Two other alternatives is, one, you can just end it for yourself, and some people do. And then there's the others who go looking for and say, okay, if this isn't my tribe, I better go find one. And who is it? And I'm not quite sure what it is. And that's the quest. That's the journey. And it sounds like that's what Gerwolf is doing here.
Well, and the book actually opens up. He's an adult. And yeah. It opens up where he's at a point where he either needs to connect with that tribe, or he can't take it anymore. He's been haunted by this raven forever. He's basically been, you know, cast out, and has such depth of loneliness that's like beyond the, oh, I'm a little lonely tonight because there's nobody to go out with me or whatever. Just, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's where he just finally decides that I need to, that's what starts his journey, is he needs to make a change,
right.
You know.
And that's Joseph Campbell. Something prods you to go, to leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're very happy with where you are, why leave?
Why leave? Why change anything? Yeah.
And so sometimes you just get forced to say, okay, here I go, you know, sort of thing. Let's do a quick station identification. So everyone, this is Jerry Fabianic on KYGT LP FM 102.7, 103.9, coming at you live here from the center of the universe, Clear Creek County, Idaho Springs, Colorado, and visiting here with my good friend Catherine Spader, talking about this fabulous work that I just can't wait to start sinking my teeth into, The Feast of the Raven. I'm not going to eat the raven. I had a little bit of turkey. I didn't really dump, but I had some turkey, so but that's a whole other thing. I am sponsoring this hour here, so if you want to find out more about my work, you can go to jerryfabianic.com. My work is Sisyphus Wins, and it seems, Catherine, we have a lot with my protagonist in my story, Jonathan, and then Gerwolf, different circumstances, settings, everything, but it follows a very similar storyline in terms of quest, you know, going off. And of course, that's Campbell. You're familiar with Campbell, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He's just everybody says, who's your favorite author? And I'm like, well, Joseph Campbell, who's not really a fiction author, but, you know, I, mm-hmm. yeah.
What got you connected? How did you discover Campbell, and why do you read his works and listen to him?
You know, I discovered Joseph Campbell on a public TV back rather late on, and I didn't find out about him in school or in college or anything. It was
Because you weren't in my English class.
Yeah. Wish I was. Yeah, he just, I flicked on the public television show, PBS show that was right. on, and he was sitting there talking to Bill Moyers. And
The Power of Myth.
Yeah, there was a whole series, and my jaw just dropped, and I was like, what is this? This is awesome, you know? And that was, I think back in the 90s.
Late 80s. He died in 87, yeah. So that series was okay. done just before he died, so
okay.
it's about
Maybe
30
it was
years
80s,
old.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's been repeated and so forth there. But I did a very similar thing, and it just made perfect sense. It helped me put all these conundrums out and questions and, what's going on here? And once I listened to Campbell and his idea of a myth, you know, not only the hero's path, that's a part of it, but the elements of myth, you know, the metaphysical, the cosmological, the psychological, and how all cultures, everybody's looking for the answers to the same questions.
Same thing, yeah.
Why are we here? How do we get here? What's going to happen when we die? You know, we're all searching for it, you know, and guess what? Nobody knows. And so we're trying to figure it out. So that's pretty amazing stuff here. So did you have him in mind as you wrote the story, or it just sort of unfolded the way it did?
Well, you know, his works, his influence is it'll probably be in every book I write, I would imagine, mm-hmm. to some degree. Maybe
exactly.
not.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty heavy-handed in this book, but I would imagine that his influence will be, I just consider him one of the wisest people ever. He's like a modern day, you know, Gandalf. Just so emotionally intelligent and so understanding and so insightful and right. and everything. So
yeah, that's what I think. He might say that we've lost our way, and that's why our country is in such conflict right now. We're conflicted as a people because our symbols have lost their meaning, and we have lost our way. And I'm going to jump back to one point when you were talking about searching for tribe, and we were discussing that there. And you know who I had in mind are these young kids in inner cities who join gangs.
Gangs, yep.
Why does that make sense? Yeah, you were thinking, as soon as I said it, you said it. Why? What jumps
in mind?
Because
that is their tribe. I mean, I can totally understand why gangs occur. You know, everybody wants to be part of something. Everybody wants to feel protected, wants to feel like they have someone they can go to, someone that's watching their back, that's mm-hmm. there for them. You know, for many of us, that's family. Mm-hmm. For many of us, it's family and friends, but, you know, in really rough circumstances, you get your family where you can, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah, and it's no different than if we go back to the medieval days and the herald with the symbol, what do I say, on the shield, on the armor, and, mm-hmm. the coat of arms.
Yeah.
Well, that was a symbol. Well, guess what a gang tag is? It's a symbol.
Yeah, that was,
it's the exact same stuff.
It's a symbol of their particular tribe, or,
yeah.
you know, and literally tribes had their own symbols, too,
mm-hmm.
for, you know, each tribe. And
yeah, no, it's amazing. When you're writing, let's just talk about the writing process. You know, people say, well, you just sit down and start writing. Sometimes people do. What was that like for you?
Well, I've been working at it since I was a little kid, and I'm 55 now, so I didn't actually publish my first book till 55. So let's just say it was a long, torturous process.
I have 10 years on you. I did it when I was 65, darling. So.
Was that your first?
Yeah. That's okay.
Yeah.
That's good.
Well, so. I think some of that is, you know, life happens, and you have work and family and all the things going on. Time, you know, time is a factor, and some of it is just there's sort of a time when you're really ready to. And I couldn't have written this book when I was 10 or 20 or even 30. Right. You know, I could have written something. I wish I had, but mm-hmm. or something publishable. But you really pour a lot into it. And amazingly enough, I thought after I finished the first one, it's like, okay, is it going to take me another 55 years to come up with the next one?
Be around a long time.
My poor husband. And honestly, some of that does come a little bit with practice and getting better at writing. And I wrote for many years as a nonfiction and medical writer, so that's still writing practice. And I'm finding with the second book that it's coming out much faster and easier than the first one. And I think some of that's just experience-based and, you know, practice, well, it won't make perfect, but it'll make better.
Anyway. Yeah. You know, I've heard, and I feel this about my work, but I've heard others, and see how you respond to this, that when I say I didn't create my story, I just put it into consciousness. That's, it came up from the unconscious, and I was the vehicle who brought that into literally keyboard and finally a printed book. Do you feel like your story or the way you write... there are others. I had a couple writers on last week, and the idea of writing, you know, the one is very structured. She lays everything out. The other one says, oh, heck no. No, I just sit and start writing. I go, yeah, I get that. You know, is it something, an act of creation, you know, the literally it's conscious thought, cerebral, or do you think this might have been something more, something inside of you, and these characters were talking to you that you just said, it's about time. I need to just start putting this to practice here or something.
Well, I think it's definitely comes from inside. I don't know where it comes from, honestly. Somewhere deep in some of my darker corners inside my brain. Yeah, some of it comes from pretty dark places inside me, but I definitely... feel like writing is, you need the cerebral part of it to continue to get better at it. You need that part of it to do the research and sort of the nuts and bolts of the story. But the heart and soul of the story, the characters, who they are, where they come from, they're just this kind of like magical thing that comes out of me, I guess. It's every one of them has, you know, bits of me and a little bit of everybody I know kind of all put in them. Mm-hmm. In fact, I tell people kind of jokingly that don't piss me off or you'll be a character in my books.
You tell people that too?
Like, you just bought yourself a character in my books.
Yeah, I'm only going to change the name because it's going to be just like you, by the way. Oh, I thought the same thing. That's hilarious. Yeah, I do the exact same thing. No, that's great stuff. But you know, when you were describing, you know, what jumped in mind, and I beat this up so much. But going back to Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, and then when Luke is with Yoda on Dagobah, and he's trying to learn everything, and he's failing miserably. And, you know, finally Yoda gives him all these pithy lines, which I love. And, you know, and he says, I can't believe it. That's after Yoda pulls the ship out of the swamp. And he says, that's the reason you fail. You know, at first he doesn't have faith in himself, but he's trying to think it. And then ultimately, you know, one of the next scenes, he goes into the cave. And that's very Campbellian there. You know, when he goes into that cave and there's the kimono dragon that's the protector and everything there. And you know, Luke goes down. And he's fighting his dad, Darth Vader. He doesn't realize it. And he knocks his head off. Who does he see but himself? And he realizes that if I don't do things appropriately, I could become my dad. I will become Darth Vader, you know, because Darth Vader was a good guy too. Once and we find redemption at the end. And that's what I'm kind of excited to read about Gerwulf here, you know, in this story. And then potentially, can he be redeemed? What is that redemption? He's the anti-hero. He's full of flaws, conflicts, and so forth. And is there hope for him? That sort of stuff that comes up too. And I know, spoiler alert, and maybe you haven't created it yet or whatever, but these are the kind of questions that jump into mind when I think about this here.
Well, this is why it's going to be a series too. So
okay.
It doesn't necessarily finish at the end of the first book, but
good.
Yeah,
and there might be a suggestion. You know, because that's what I thought, or I am thinking too with mine. And I thought maybe I'd do is create a trilogy.
Yeah,
and then bring it to completion and so forth like that at some point there. But
there's a reason why trilogies work a lot of times, and that is because sometimes these type of journeys have these sort of three phases, you know, and it's kind of the classic, you make progress in the first one, and the second one you get knocked back down, and then the third one you finally have the triumph, and that's kind of the
I would do that when I talk, with my students, because I used to teach Star Wars. And I figured out, I had watched Campbell, and I was teaching freshman English, and I was teaching the Odyssey, and I was looking for some other stuff, and of course I had Campbell there, and I realized a lot of his stuff was going to be way over their heads, the way he's talking, but his concepts were very understandable to them. And of course, he says, George Lucas, Star Wars, that's the Odyssey, this is modern. I went, oh, perfect, And so my freshman boys come in and go, oh, we get to watch Star Wars, and say, but you will know Star Wars, you will know the mythic part, you will know the archetype. And they did, and they loved it. And I would draw this line on the board that went up, like his first path, he ascends and he's heroic, but then the descent.
Yeah.
And then, bam, Empire Strikes Back. He loses his hand. He discovers his father is this nefarious character. And then resurrection. And I would talk to him and say, in Christian belief, in the Christian mythology, you see the same thing with Jesus. Okay? He works miracles. He suffers and dies, descends into hell, and then he resurrects and goes into heaven, ascension, and everything. It's the same story is really what it gets down to there. Comes in. I would love it. Do you have a selection in your novel here that you could share with us?
Sure.
I'm just so hooked into this. I'm going to sit down tonight and say, okay, fine.
Okay. This is fairly close to the beginning, and this is where Gerwulf, our Wolfhead and anti-hero, has kidnapped a monk who he thinks is going to be the key to getting him back into society. What he wants to do is he thinks the king holds something called the Holy Spear, which is a relic that supposedly has all these great powers in it and everything. Mm-hmm. And he believes if he can get the monk to take him to the Holy Spear and he can touch it and stuff, he'll be redeemed, thinking in a very simplistic manner that that's all it will take to redeem him. So the monk and they are on their way then to go. The monk agrees to do this after being forced at the point of an axe blade, and they're on their way to go do this when they get attacked in the forest, and they had to fight back. They were attacked in the dark, ambushed. They fought back, and then they, once the fighting's over, they kind of see who it was that attacked them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Their bodies were small and thin, barely more than boys. They were as ragged and poorly armed as the older man. Their smashed faces were unrecognizable now, but they had shared the fair hair and the round faces of the Saxon tribes. They had resembled each other and were probably kin, father and sons. A wife and other children likely waited at home for their return. More things the wolf had not noticed. Brother Pytel placed the cross on the man's chest. "Starving Saxon peasants," he said. "Many of these farmers on the borderlands have lost everything in the king's campaigns, even the ones who converted to Christianity. They now survive by attacking those who wander in the Teutoburg forest. The woods are thick with these farmer bandits." The raven dies from the dark sky, alighting on the father. Another dead, slain by the wolf, by my own hand, their blood drying on my body, marking me. Blood-stained beak, she drinks her fill and flies away. Red eyes fade into night, vanishing with the soul she carries, quenched, never satisfied. Bring me more, Wolfhedden. The monk's gaze followed mine into the sky. "What are you looking at?" he asked. I shook my head. He shrugged his shoulders, knelt, and held his hands over the bodies. Lord God, forgive these peasants for their folly. Bring them into your kingdom of heaven. Amen. He stood, his face grave. Do you not pray? No, not anymore. He frowned and wandered a few steps away. Where are you going? I asked. He stopped at a pool of stagnant water. We must wash, because it is over. Over. He waded into the pool and dunked his head. When he came up for air, he was staring into nowhere. Then he plunged into the murky water and stayed under longer than I could hold my own breath. I waded in to pull him out, but he jumped up, coughing and gasping for air. Move on, I said, keeping my long axe in hand. He stumbled out of the water and mumbled, is over, is over. I hardened my heart and steadied my sight forward. We continued through the forest, following a narrow animal track. How much farther? I asked. We are about halfway there, he said. Our path soon became overgrown with thickets, and we had to pick our way slowly through the thorny branches. Is there no better way? I snapped. Not if you want to remain hidden, Brother Pytel said, freeing his habit slowly from the thorns. You remind me of a story, a tale that Frankish mothers tell their children to keep them from wandering into the woodland. They talk of a troubled boy, a bastard, born the son of a Frankish woman who was raped by a Saxon wolf Hedin, a demon wolf warrior. The wolf aches, his call carries pain, far, yet so near, alone in his grief. I could not stand to hear it, to feel it again. Shut your mouth. He persisted, speaking rapidly. His mother baptized the boy a Christian, but that did not drive out his father's beast. She sent him to the monastery to shield him from the demon, but the boy defied God and embraced the wolf spirit, invoking it with magic to give him the strength and fury of no other. They say he even killed a monk. I grabbed him and threw him into the thorn bush. No more. He winced but continued. They call him Demon Seed. They excommunicated him from the church and banished him into the wilds, a lone wolf that hunts the woodlands to this day. A few tiny drops of his blood dripped from the scratches made by the thorns. I grabbed him by the throat. A single swing of the axe would silence him, end it. Poised low on haunches, scruffed raised, ready to attack, kill him, release the rage. The raven lurks above, screaming for his blood. Feed the wolf, feed the raven. Will the beast kill another monk, or will he return to God? The monk gasps. I released his throat and threw him down. He rolled onto the ground, coughing. Fight for God, he cried, his eyes darting. What are you saying, monk? The spirit will not give you what you seek. What would you know of it? Have any of those relics hanging around your neck given you peace? My blood cools as I fingered each ears, nose, and bone. Relics will not protect you from the beast, he said, and they will not save your soul. He measured his words, speaking clearly. You cannot invoke God with magic. Grace dwells not in the spear, but in the deed. Relics can only inspire the deed. You must fight for your soul. Fight for my soul? What did he mean? The monk was mad enough to confront me with my past, but was also cunning and clever, perhaps too clever. Fight for King Carl, he said. I fight for no king. God's chosen king, the holder of the Holy Spear, he said. King Carl has united most of the kingdoms north of Rome in Christianity, but he has failed to bring all the pagan Saxons to God. Spirits roam in their forests. The old gods still rule. There are rumors that the rebel pagans are raising an army of wolf Hednar, undefeatable wolf warriors, just like you. He scratched his chin. The king cannot defeat them with mortal soldiers alone. He needs a demon to conquer demons. He needs you. I glared at him. Why should I fight for him? What will it do for me? Far more than the Holy Spirit can do. Loyalty to King Carl is loyalty to God, the promise of heavenly grace. I grappled with the idea. Why should I trust you? Because my sins are as great as yours, he sighed and paused. What is your real name, Wolf Hedin? I hesitated. No one had asked in many years. You cannot exist without a name. I don't exist. He frowned. A man must have a name, even a man who has been banished. Geralt, I said. Geralt, he repeated. You must fight, Geralt. You certainly know how to do that. You have fought and killed to damn your soul. Will you not do as much to save it? He did not let me answer. Good, he said. You may save us both.
Wow. Oh, my God. The vivid imagery of the forest, it's just like you're walking with them. Just the language itself, it's so easy to move to that place, that time, that dark place and everything, and its conflict, even the thorns coming out and the drops of the blood and so forth there. And we're starting to understand the conflict. you know, that this, I guess, young guy is.
Is a 30-ish, I'd say. He's mature.
He's an adult now.
He's definitely a mature adult. He's not a kid yet, or even a late teen.
But now, as an adult, which we are, because that's when we're, you know, coming to grips with our stuff and everything, too, all the conflict within him. That's pretty powerful writing.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, my God, yeah. It's a, yeah, and as we were talking earlier here, the, yeah, the different elements you bring in here, the in the spiritual traditions, because if you're those on the that are Christian and early, and it comes from early Christianity, and saw the forest as dark and evil, and you know, and the wolf, you know, Little Red Riding Hood again, the wolf is a bad character.
From their perspective, the wolf is the bad character.
And it was always negative. Yet when you get to Native American mythology, the wolf is a good character.
And the Saxon pagans, they worship the strength and you know, ferocity of a wolf, too. In fact, that's why their elite warriors, you know, had a wolf cult.
And would wear their skins.
And
probably the wolf head on their...
The wolf head that goes down over their eyes and, you know.
Yeah. No, this is powerful stuff you have in here. So you're to be congratulated, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I am so excited to read this here. So you have another, the second one is going to be a series, you said.
It's going to be a series. The second one is going to be out by end of February.
Okay.
And also the audiobook is coming out within a couple of weeks.
Yay, me too.
Congratulations.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Because there are people, I had Richard actually, who did your book and has done mine, audio. He came on the show with me here and explaining that, and it makes sense, you know, so many people just either in their busy lives, so they're driving from here to, you know, Florida and don't want to listen to music, so they'll put it in. And then there's others, you know, maybe with a visual disability, you know, they can still sink themselves into the story. So audiobooks are really starting to rise more than even the ebook, from what I'm
understanding. Yeah, that's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing the college kids like them too, because they get tired of reading. They have to do so much reading for school, and then this is something they can do, you know, for entertainment that's not more reading, you know.
Right. And that would be a fun thing if I were still in the classroom to do with my students, to have them read a selection of some sort, maybe even like your book, your first chapter anyway, and then listen to the audio version and see if the narrator delivers it the way they imagined it.
Yeah, that would be interesting to
I used to do out. When I taught the eighth grade, I had High Noon in my book, the script of the movie, you know, with Gary Cooper and Grace Kelly and everything. And we would read it, and then we'd watch the video, the movie. It was VHS then at that time. And it was always fun for them, because they'd see themselves as a character, and then the way it was portrayed in the movie, and say, is that the way you saw it, or how you feel and everything? So it got them thinking, because, you know, when we read, we're left to our own imaginations. And so the manipulation of the author, you or me, of the mental, but, you know, I read it, you read it, and we may have little different reactions to it simply because of our life's experiences, too. So, oh, this is great stuff, Catherine. Really nice. If people want to learn more, get more, contact you, find out more about your book, get it. Where, how?
The book is on Amazon, Feast of the Raven. I've got a webpage, CatherineSpader.com, which is...
Spell Catherine, because there's a couple ways.
Yes, it's CatherineSpader.com, or you can go to FeastoftheRaven.com. It goes to the same place. That might be easier to remember.
Okay.
And you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter.
Nice.
Pinterest, and the list goes on and on.
We didn't
get into authors' marketing and social media, but that's topic for another day. Right?
Oh, tell me all about that. And just remind everybody, we recorded the show, and then I will have it on my website probably by Tuesday or so. first of next week, and our program director will need to load it up too, and then I grab it and move it over. And so, and we will rebroadcast this on Monday at 2 o'clock.
Okay.
So if you're available Monday and I want to hear yourself on the radio, you just go to KYGT.org, just like your friends and family have done today, to listen to you live. And it'll be rebroadcast a couple times through the week. So Monday at 2 o'clock, and of course I'll have it on the website, and then you can hook into it or however you want to do it there. But I want to thank you so much for coming up.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, intriguing, great. Intriguing discussion here. I love this stuff. You say Joseph Campbell and mythology and wolf, and I go like, okay, I'm there. You got me. You got me.
You won't get me to be quiet after that. Yeah,
totally.
Let's get going. So
looking forward to this here. So, all right, everyone. This is Jerry Fabianica, KYGT, LPFM, 102.7, 103.9. We're going to take a bit of a music interlude, and I'll be back with my next author here in about 5-10 minutes. So in the meantime, just hang on. Maybe make yourself a cup of coffee or pour yourself a beer, whatever you're doing on a Saturday afternoon. Enjoy the time. And then join me back in, and we'll be talking with our next guy. And at any rate, I'll be back in about 5-10 minutes. All right. Thanks, Al. Hang on.